We are back completely switching gears. We head to the national stage where impeachment hearings round two. This in the hands of the House Judiciary Committee. And Jerry Nadler, and here to discuss is David Caputo. Of course, David, a wonderful job he does as far as Emeritus of Pace. Everybody knows that, retired Pace professor of political science. Always a welcome addition. Sir, how are you?
I'm fine. Jay, yourself?
I'm okay. I'm okay. You know, I had it on in the background yesterday. Listen, for me, the star of the day is when I really kind of perked up was Professor Jonathan Turley. Let's just recap a little bit. Four professors really kind of giving you the history as far as impeachment is concerned. Three obviously siding as far as the ouster of the current president, one kind of defending the defending him, that being Turley. But I think Turley, well, I'm going to ask for your overall assessment yesterday, David, but I think Professor Turley did a little bit of a reversal on the committee. And I'll tell you one thing, it had to be a little indigestion. And that and the likes of Jerry Nadler after he heard that. Give me the assessment overall. Give me what you thought of Turley.
Well, before I do that, just let me put this in a little bit of context for you. This is an extremely important set of hearings, and yesterday's hearing was, and the whole impeachment process is, because what we may see here is a real redefinition or a subsequent definition of the power of the presidency under Article 2. Going forward, and this is usually done by the courts. It may be done through the impeachment process this time, and then perhaps by the courts. It remains to be seen. The other thing is there are multiple players involved here, not just the president, but other members of the administration. There are also this is happening during hyperpartisanship, so it makes it unique. So, and for that, with that as background, I think you have to put the hearings yesterday into that context, and I think three of the four were clearly brought in because of their positions, and I think Turley clearly from his work with the Clinton impeachment and so forth was brought by the Republicans to make their arguments. I think he made some interesting points in terms of the timing, in terms of the process, and in terms of what should be done in terms of the case. He did not argue necessarily that if the case had been made, that the president would be above the law. In fact, I thought he argued just the obvious. I think the other three made their points. The difficulty is, as someone who teaches and has taught parts of constitutional law in American politics courses that I've taught over the years, is you can go back to the Federalist Papers, you can go back to the Founding Convention, you can see what has been said since then, and it's all subject to different interpretations. You have different understanding of what different words meant back then and so forth. And you can find anyone who's a good scholar can find different positions and take and argue those positions. And I think that's what we saw yesterday. And I think the difficulty for the Democrats going forward is they have to decide what they're going to do in terms of timing. Are they going to push ahead, how broad, what's going to happen with the various articles of impeachment and so forth. And for the Republicans, I think it was clear yesterday that they still don't have a clear line of argument as to why nothing occurred of any significance. So I thought yesterday was certainly an interesting day for constitutional law scholars, probably less insightful perhaps for individuals who were trying to follow this. But the argument is very clear. We're talking about a redefinition of Article 2 in terms of presidential power. And that, I think, is something that we all need to be concerned about and interested in. And it's not only in terms of the Trump presidency, but it's a future presidents also. So sorry to go on so long, but I think it's important that people understand that this is complicated.
That's an excellent clarification. No question. Dave Caputo with us. See, my only thing is, and I thought Turley hit some key points here. He kept terming the rush to impeach an abuse of power by the House, and not the only one. You know, I mean, obviously you're looking at and eyeing on impeachment here, the count for obstruction, because Trump demanding court rulings before allowing top aides to testify in these hearings. And I thought Turley came back, you know, if you make this high crime and misdemeanor out of going to the courts, it's an abuse of power. And it's the abuse of power by the House. And basically, to me, and he accentuated this several times, I thought, that you're doing precisely what you're criticizing the president of doing, meaning the House, as far as what's going on here. So he hit the point again and again and again. I thought he did a great job, Turley did. I thought, to me, he was the star of the panel. I thought he did a wonderful job citing, you know, the effort to remove Andrew Johnson, 19th century effort to remove him. You know, kind of generally viewed as an abusive act of impeachment by most scholars, yet has been cited as a basis for the current impeachment. But I thought overall he slammed the House. To me, you know, the insane rush, you know, you look at Adam Schiff's charge, you know, that the, I mean, to me, it's ridiculous what Schiff is citing it. These crimes are worse than what President Richard Nixon did. Are you kidding me? The claim that the controversy over Ukraine eclipses what happened in the 70s with Watergate. I'm sorry. I mean, that's going a little bit off kilter here, don't you think?
Well, I think you have to, again, put this in a bit of context. I mean, the House response, the Democratic response as to why they need to move quickly is if you have a president who is abusing power and is acting illegally under the Constitution, you have to move to curtail that action. Otherwise, it's going to continue and get worse, and you run the risk that he'll become all-powerful, and you will not, as the other three argued, you have a monarchical president, and you're unable to control him. In terms of comparison with different cases, I think each of the cases is very unique. I think it's very difficult to compare them. And again, you have to understand this in terms of the hyperpartisanship. But to me, the broader question and the interesting one, I mean, if I were making the decision, I would simply say, look, this can be very easily resolved. In terms of the seriousness and in the terms of the complexity and who all was involved, by simply having some of the key people testify. There's, you know, it could be done relatively quickly. It could be done easily. It could be done under oath. If they say there was no discussion of a quid pro quo, there was no discussion of holding the money up and so forth, then case closed, impeachment's over, the process stops. But without that testimony, I think it's going to be very hard to proceed with the trial. I think it's going to be very hard for Chief Justice Roberts to deny a request that these people, that these individuals testify. I think the administration will fight that. And the question is why? Why fight it? If you've done nothing wrong, bring forth these individuals, let them testify, and on these points, and claim executive privilege where you need to, where it's a matter of important national security. But certainly, so much has come out about this at this point that it seems to me this is the way out for everybody. But I don't think it's going to happen. I think the Democrats are going to push. I think the key here will be how broad the articles of impeachment are going to be and what the impact is likely to be going forward.
Yeah, I still think it's amazing, you know, even when this thing began yesterday, you know, even the opening remarks of Nadler, the opening testimony of these professors, you know, they kind of have shifted their impeachment case. You know, now, of course, it's not about bribery. Now it's about accusing the president of having abused his office. And, you know, it's interesting, before this latest hearing, David, very peculiar that they were yet as mentioned, you know, we talked about this. No proposed articles of impeachment. You know, in prior cases, experts have been called off of their views on such articles the House had already formulated. And, you know, it's kind of a little bit of a twist here when you think about it, you know?
Well, again, each of the impeachment proceedings in the past have been somewhat unique. And unique to the setting and to the case, and this is the case here. There's still the opportunity once they frame the articles to have a hearing. Whether or not they will or not remains to be seen. But I think the other thing that's important here is that while all this is going on, and clearly the president has to be distracted and his staff has to be distracted, you have tremendous developments around the world that, in terms of where U.S. interests are being threatened.
Without question. I mean, you know, we just had a NATO deal. The president abruptly kind of leaving the U.K. No one's talking about that. You know, I mean, it's unbelievable. Nobody's talking about funding a government that could run out of money. To me, you know, this is the most partisan thing I've ever seen in my life. The divide keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. You wonder where this thing is going. You know, it's going to go to the Senate, and it'll probably die in the Senate. But in essence, damage being done on a daily basis here. And really, you know, people are kind of citing that here and there, but there's other problems that people are not engaging with right now. Important stuff. Thus, the continued dysfunction of our government.
Well, I think given the polling and everything that we've seen, there's still some, great interest in this and in terms of the significance of it. The difficulty is that there are other things that also are going on around the world. And how much is this distracting? It's just not the NATO meeting. You've got the discussion about what the Christmas gift from the North Koreans are going to be. You have the Iranian in domestic violence. You have the discussion that perhaps Iran has now put some short-term missiles into Iraq. You have the British elections coming up and what all that indicates. You have the Israeli stalemate. I mean, you could go on and on. But I would point out one thing. The administration has been moving on different areas, and I think the development with the SNAP program, the food stamp program, part of the food stamp program yesterday is very significant. And I think it's significant for another reason, and that is because of the potential impact on the farm states. But I digress. Let me go back to your point. I think this is going to stay front and center. I think the House Democrats have decided they've got to proceed with this. How quickly they're going to proceed, I think, is going to be the interesting answer and the interesting question. There appears to be some members who are saying, well, perhaps we do need to have more evidence, but where do they go for that evidence? If you can't get people to testify, court decisions are not going to be reasonably timed. They could be months, even a year away, and you don't know what the outcome of that is going to be. The fundamental question here is if the under the Constitution, with a House responsibility for impeachment, they have to have the tools to undertake their investigation. If legal challenges and judicial challenges are used to block that, you're really reinforcing the power of the executive. And I think this is something that cannot be overlooked in terms of this is the significance of this case. If you've accused someone of high crimes and misdemeanors, and you cannot investigate them, you cannot get the information that you need, then I think it becomes very very difficult to make a case. So I think you can argue, this is the type of case you can argue on both the political aspects of it and also the policy aspects of it. And I think long term, I was a little surprised yesterday in the testimony. They kept referring, well, if we don't resolve this now in X or Y way, it sets precedent for the future. But they really didn't talk about the implications of that precedent. They did a little bit in some of the follow-up questioning, especially by the Republicans. But that I think, is really the critical point. This impeachment proceeding is not just about impeaching this president. It's about fundamental constitutional change in the United States. And I think it's very significant, and people do need to pay attention to it as we go forward.
David, it is also so apparent here. It's a rush to judgment. It's a rush to impeach. And listen, they know we are, 56 days out from the Iowa caucuses? Okay, they want this done quick. They would love to put a little bow under the tree there, okay, as far as this ouster is concerned. This is so obvious as a speed lining to get this thing done quick. I mean, it is so fast and furious right now. I think Nadler's head is coming off. He was bumbling and stumbling all throughout this thing yesterday. And I think Turley said it best. That's the abuse of what's happening right now within these hearings. They are trying to expedite everything to a point where it's completely unmanageable right now.
You certainly can make that argument, but there's also a counter-argument, and that counter-argument would be it would be best for the Republicans to get this done if it's going to happen, and it certainly appears that it's going to happen, whether it's slow or fast, that there will be articles of impeachment voted on in the House. Don't know for sure what that outcome would be, but assuming that the outcome is to impeach, it's to the Republicans' advantage, I would argue, to get this resolved quickly, and then they can move on in terms of the reelection campaign also. So right now there's certainly no evidence that there's going to be any significant support for it among the Republicans, in certainly not enough support among any Republicans in the Senate to actually remove the president, to convict him. So given that, if I were a Republican strategist, I would say, well, look, let's continue to critique the House for moving too fast. But that actually is to our advantage, because we get it in the Senate, we get a trial over, we get the verdict in terms of non-agreement, no vote to convict, and we move on. And it strengthens the president going into the re-election. I think it weakens them in terms of the re-election campaign to have this dragging on into late spring, early summer, or even into the fall.
Case, but it certainly, you know, you can make the case that it weakens Democrats as far as this movement is concerned, for the obvious nature of prolonging a situation. If you look at the numbers, they are actually going on the side of Donald Trump as far as, you know what, they don't want any part of this now. There's other issues that we have to contend with. If you look at those numbers, they're kind of creeping up a little bit, but you could make this case that it is hurting the other side as far as the prolonged activity within the ranks here.
Well, that's true, but I think the Democrats do have a very valid point when they raise and point to all the legislation that the House has passed, in which the Senate under McConnell's leadership has simply refused to take up. And I think that is going to be a telling point for many Americans. I think they're going to say, well, wait, the House has not been totally set on this. I think the key will come when we get to the continuing resolution in terms of the budget as to what's going to happen. And my guess is they're not going to be able to agree, and they'll have to pass another continuing resolution for how long. And at some point, someone's going to have to more or less blink and say, no, no continuing resolution. We have to resolve this. But it's a complicated mess. It's complicated by the timing of the election. It's complicated by the timing of the nominating process. That has an impact on the Democratic process in terms of their being able to get their candidates out and do the things that they want to do, because some of them will be back for the trial in the Senate whenever that occurs, if it occurs. So it's a mess. That's the only way to talk about it. But constitutional change is never easy. It never comes without conflict, and it comes ultimately the American public is going to make the decision as to whether or not this was merited or not merited, whether or not the tactics used make sense or don't make sense, and more broadly point is what does this mean for trust and faith in our institutions? And just as your previous interview indicated, about the judicial process and with a local case, this is also complicated, and the process has to play out, as difficult as it may be.
Minutes with David Caputo. Now, a couple of quick ones for you. Now, you could take it for what you want, but when I hear about a Hillary Clinton going on a Howard Stern show, now listen, I understand you're promoting a book, but I also think there's some sort of an underlying situation here brewing. Listen, I know she's getting a lot of pleas to run 2020. I think she's taking it very seriously right now. I think she sees the landscape. She sees Elizabeth Warren kind of stalling somewhat She sees Buttigieg leading in Iowa. That's a deal in which, you know, you say, okay, I think I could overcome that. You also have a situation of Michael Bloomberg entering the race a couple of weeks ago, and in my opinion, and I said it yesterday, watching paint dry could be a little more interesting than you hear the remarks of Bloomberg these days. I think you heard himself with a whole apology tour. That's a whole nother stance for another day, you know, the stop and frisk deal. I look at Hillary right now as, you know, appearance on Stern show yesterday, want to kind of garner support, building a little bit of a wave here. Do you happen to see the possibility of Hillary entering this race?
Anything's possible. Nothing would surprise me in this race, especially given the fact that the Democrats claim their number one task is to defeat the incumbent president. But they're stumbling over themselves in a lot of ways. But I think the interesting question about Hillary or anyone else who may come in, and with Mayor Bloomberg, does this really mean that we are likely to have this decision made at the convention and not going into the convention? Remember, in 16, Hillary and Bernie fought to the very end, but with the superdelegates, Hillary was able to go into that convention knowing that she had it on the first ballot. I think it's very unlikely at this point, although it could change, but I think it's unlikely at this point that anyone, except possibly Biden, would go into the convention with enough votes on that first ballot. Remember, the superdelegates are not voting on the first ballot in the convention this time. So that means you're really talking about the delegates that you pick up in the caucuses and in the primaries. So I think we'll know a lot more after the March Super Tuesday, because by then about a third to 40% of the delegates will have been selected, and we can see. But I think clearly Mrs. Clinton would have to be considering this. I think she was looking at this from the beginning. I mean, look at her position. Her position would have to be, look, I was wrong in the 16 election. It was stolen from me. I won the popular vote of 80,000 votes or so in three states, and I would have won the Electoral College. Therefore, you know, I have every reason to want to run. I think, however, it's very difficult for her to jump in at this point, given what has to happen in preparation for Super Tuesday. I read Mayor Bloomberg's entry not as a sign that he believes he can get enough delegates during this process, but he may pick up enough delegates that he, in fact, would be in position to have some influence in the convention itself. So, and remember, the Democratic convention is early; it's in July, so that gives them enough time to then marshal their resources afterwards. So, again, the 2020 is a case study in the differences. People who try to draw comparisons with prior elections and so forth, I think, are doing so at great risk to themselves in terms of their professional reputations, because it is unique. It is unique because of the Trump presidency, because of the impeachment process, because of everything that's going on. And so I think it's very difficult to handicap this at this point.
And quickly, David, you know, I think cryptically it came out yesterday, at least from my mindset with Joe Biden. And I thought that Kamala Harris, who dropped out of the race, just doesn't have the funds to do it. You need cash. I mean, and I said it yesterday, any level you're running on, local, forget it. You know, if you have $0, you can't win. That's what it comes down to. But I think cryptically, Joe Biden, a lot of nice things to say about Kamala Harris speaking to her and everything else. I think if he gets the nomination, she, without question in my mind, is going to be his running mate. And I think that would be a pretty formidable team. I mean, you know, Biden, Harris, you know. Listen, Kamala Harris made a big splash. They were going at it. First debate, we know that, over segregation. She hit a home run and then just didn't have the sea legs after that, nor the cash. But I think she'd be a wonderful running mate for Biden there. Your thought?
Well, she in many respects would be, but there are others that he may want to think of also. Primarily because of the geography. She brings him strength in the West and strength among the progressive wing of the party. But what does she do in states like the key electoral college states? Does she help him in Arizona? Does she help him if he gets the nomination in Wisconsin, the upper Midwest, and so forth. So I would not rule out Amy Klobuchar yet. And I think there are numerous other people that Biden would think about. I think the key for the Democrats, though, at this point, is that with her dropping out and with Cory Booker having his difficulty raising funds, also that you end up with all white people at these debates and so forth. And I think that sends a message to the people of color who have supported the Democrats over the years. And I think they have got to wonder, well, why can't our candidates raise the money that other candidates are able to raise? So, again, I think it puts us in a very unique situation for this 2020 election.
I don't care how much money Tom Steyer has. He should not be part of the panel on December the 19th. And that's where you have these discrepancies that come into play. Just not right. David? Always a pleasure. A lot on the plate here. And I am sure, sir, we will talk very soon. How's that?
Very good. Thank you, Jay.
Always a pleasure. The great David Caputo, of course, President Emeritus of PACE, retired PACE professor of political science of extraordinaire.